very much for coming today. We're super excited to share with you some of the work that we've been doing for the next version of Visual Studio and Visual C++ to harness GPUs and other heterogeneous computing and to make them accessible to lots and lots of programmers in ways that maybe you've never seen before. So what I'm going to talk about as far as what we're doing in our product, it's not a research project, it's about the next version of Visual Studio, but not everybody uses Visual Studio. Not everybody programs for Windows, and I hope that most of what we have to say is relevant to you no matter what platform or compiler you're using, because we're all facing the same challenges together as an industry. Before I talk about the specifics, then let me set the stage for where we are as an industry, what our view is of the landscape, and that will inform some of the design choices we made and make it clear why we did things the way we did. First, a quick progress report. As an industry, we've done a lot in just 35 years. From 1975 until 2005, not just Microsoft, the whole industry has made a revolutionary transformation, has succeeded in putting a computer on every desk instead of a typewriter, in every home, and we've actually exceeded that expectation, better or worse, putting one in every pocket. And lots of other places we probably didn't think we'd have little glowing rectangles that have taken over our lives. Now, during that whole time, we've also been making processor cores more and more complex to run single threads of execution faster. That free lunch lasted for about 30 years, and it was great. You could ship an application, it would just get faster and faster. And of course, the free lunch was over about 6 years ago, and now since then, we've been busily as an industry putting a parallel supercomputer on every desk, in every living room, in every pocket. And I'm saying 2005 till 2011 because this year is special. This is the first year that we can say that we have achieved that, bringing that to the mainstream, because this is the first year that mainstream computer tablets and smartphones are dual core. We're there. And in fact, we're not only there toward the end of the first phase of the concurrency revolution, but we're now entering the second phase, where we're now putting a heterogeneous supercomputer over the next coming years on every desk, in every living room, in every pocket. That is an enormous transformation. I've talked a lot about the mainstream, so let me define what I mean by that. I mean stuff that millions and millions of people buy, that your mom will buy, can afford, and is able to use. But I also mean us, because as developers, it's no good if we can't write the code, if we can't program it. So I'm also talking about the mainstream as commercially programmable, not by a select priesthood, but by millions of people, which is a different bar. Now, the question is, can we do that for parallel programming? A lot of people have questioned that, and I think the answer is clearly yes, because we've done it before. We have done it for GUIs. We have done it for objects. We are now in the middle of a 5 to 7 year process, just like the others, of bringing this next technology into the mainstream. After it's been the domain of a priesthood for many years, it's time for the limelight is now, and we are busily bringing it in. But just like with GUIs, it takes multiple major releases of operating systems, compilers, new languages and frameworks that take existing languages and let you work with it, like, for instance, MFC and OWL for C++ to do GUI programming, to put the message pump into the operating system instead of having to crack messages and run your message pump by hand. Also to have new languages like Visual Basic and Delphi that expanded GUI programming to even more people, for better or worse, because sometimes they should not have written the GUI code, but the point was they could. And that was bringing it to the mainstream. It also involved tooling, object inspectors, debuggers, profilers. It involved education, books, conferences, Grady Booch getting up and saying, what is an object, when it was time to bring objects into the mainstream, because nobody knew. And now we all know. And now we're doing the same thing for parallelism. If you think about mainstream compute trends, if you look at the press, you will see three things mentioned a lot. They are multi-core CPUs, that first phase of the concurrency revolution, GPGPU, which is of great interest to us here, and also cloud. And by cloud, there's several flavors, and I don't mean platform as a service or software as a service. I mean infrastructure or hardware as a service. Those are synonyms, meaning cloud access to lots of hardware that I can run my application on. The most important point I can make here is that we don't agree that those are three important trends. We think that they are only aspects of one trend, the same trend, which is to heterogeneous parallel computing. And I'm going to try to justify that by the way we segment the landscape and show that they all fit on the same chart. And unless you have that chart in mind, you cannot provide a complete solution that will handle all three. And that's the thesis of what drove us to do what we have done, which I'll show you. But just as a teaser, if you were put on the spot, somebody said to you, you came back from the conference, oh, heterogeneous computing is the new thing, and somebody said, well, what's a mainstream application? That's a nice conversation stopper right there. Except we can now point to lots of mainstream applications. Let me point to just one category of mainstream application that would not be possible today, that's commercially available at Best Buy, if we didn't have heterogeneous computing on CPUs and GPUs. And that is every Kinect game there is. Because the game itself could not run if it weren't for the heavy-duty processor cores, the CPUs. And the Kinect software could not run without the GPUs. Now, if you look at the way the Kinect software is built, it's doing an amazing amount of work that is, by definition, super scalably parallel. What the Kinect peripheral does is very little. It just ships the raw data stream over the wire to the Xbox. On the Xbox, the Kinect software spreads the computation load across the six logical GPU cores, that's 3x2, and across the much wider GPU cores. And if it weren't for those GPU cores, Kinect could not work because it has way too much work to do, of a kind that works great for GPUs. The questions it has to answer are ones like this. Is this pixel 80% likely to be a shoulder, 60% likely to be an elbow, 20% likely to be part of a chest? As soon as you say for every pixel, you have a massively parallel program. So every Kinect game I show is an entire class of mainstream applications you can go and buy today that would not be possible without heterogeneous computing. The trouble is today you have to program it in a priesthood. Just like GUIs back in the early 90s, you had to write your message pump by hand, crack messages by hand. And the trouble with that is only a few people can do it. Hello World takes a page and a half. And the people who can do it are not very productive because it takes a long time to actually get anything done. Bringing it to the mainstream means making us more productive and broadening it to many more people. So let's chart the landscape, and I'm going to stick with this view because I think it's a very good one for thinking about where the entire computing landscape is going. On the one axis, we're talking about differences in processors, which is the main thing we've been talking about so far. But there's another axis, and people sometimes confuse these two, and then they get muddled in how they think about the problem. Keep it separate. Memory architecture is separate. Any kind of processor might work on any kind of memory architecture. So let's talk about the processors first. Because we've gone to these big, fat, out-of-order cores with pipelining, branch prediction, speculation, all this good stuff that runs our single thread faster, we use a lot of power to do that, but we gain generality. This is the kind of core you want to run legacy applications on, and every new application you write where there's an Amdahl's law problem, where there's a sequential part. You might be able to partly parallelize your program by having a pipeline, but you're going to be dominated by the most heavy pipeline stage. You want to run that on the fastest core you can get. So there are workloads for these cores. I do not believe they are going away. There are workloads for these cores. But they're not getting exponentially faster, they're just getting incrementally faster for a single thread. Now, if you take the pendulum back a little bit, imagine a hypothetical core that was just like that out-of-order core, it was modern, but we strip off 3/4 of the transistors. And what we do is we take away some of the out-of-order processing, speculation, branch prediction, and we have the core itself, but without a lot of that extra stuff that hides memory latency, and so we need more parallelism, hardware threads. But the main thing is we have a core that is 1/4 the size. There's many other points, but let's imagine this one. Now you've got a core that is one quarter of the size. It is not going to run your general purpose application as fast as the big fast core did. But there's a unique property. You can build such a core with first equal floating point throughput to the big fat core, and second, taking less than one quarter the power. Which means that you can have a chip that does four times the compute throughput at less total power, and what is not to like about that? If you have a general purpose program, you still need the full modern language of C++ with exceptions, with everything. But you can parallelize it. You want to run on that kind of core because you will get much better performance per watt. And run the sequential parts of your application, of the same application, on the big fat core. Now, of course, GPUs have been coming in, and we have different instruction sets. GPUs are just one example of a class of more specialized cores. And the further higher up we go here, the more specialized the core, the less general purpose your code can be. The less assumptions the hardware can make about the more assumptions the hardware can make about the order in which you're going to access memory, for example. In the extreme, which is off the chart because it's not interesting, is those fixed function units we used to have, where all you could do is throw a few instructions at a pixel as it went by. Very predictable. You knew exactly what the memory order was because you didn't get to ask for memory. It was handed to you. But also, it was very, very constrained and off the top of this chart because you can't really do general purpose interesting computation with that. But GPUs are in the middle because you can do general purpose computation, but you don't have necessarily the full C++ language. There are lots of functions like Kinect's probability algorithm for identifying pixels and associating them with human body parts that want to run on those cores. And if nothing else, the main point to take away from this is that every single one of these cores has a workload that wants to run on it. Therefore, we have imperative to actually ship you all of these cores, and we're doing it. That's why we're here. Now, on the other axis, memory, back in the single core, single processor era, we were used to having just one chunk of RAM and one cache pyramid with a core sitting on top. You had to worry about fitting in cache, but that was about it. Taking a step away and relaxing that, the second column is about really multi-core, traditional multi-core today. Because this column is about having multiple peaks of memory, of cache. Still one memory, but multiple cache peaks, each with a core sitting on top, pulling up from the memory. And now you have to deal with things like cache sloshing, and you have to deal with that some cores share caches and other cores are further away and don't. Relax it a bit further. The next thing you might say is non-uniform is RAM itself. Now, the third column is a model where you can still make a pointer to anything. But some RAM is closer to some cores than others. This is the model of many intermediate and modern GPUs and some GPU roadmaps that are out there for having some memory on the GPU, some memory on the CPU, but you can form the same pointer to both of them. As those kinds of architectures, that's what this column is about. Now let's relax it a bit further. Incoherent memory that we all love, where you get to say, oh, by the way, please sync my cache for me, because by default I'm going to assume you don't care about having a unified worldview, and so then you get to sync your caches or somehow arrange for it to be done on your behalf. And now we make a small but important jump to saying, well, let's just cut the cord. We'll have disjoint memory. Now we'll have it locally, tightly in box. This column is about GPUs on discrete cards, the way we've come to know them over the last couple of years, where they have their own memory, the CPU has its own memory, the cell architecture is similar. You want to shove work over to the GPU or to the SPE, you have to copy the data first. Then you have to copy the answer back because the memory address spaces are not the same. And once you've done that, it is one small but important step to say they're still disjoint, but they're loosely coupled. And this column is the cloud. It is on the same chart as multi-core and GPU. Now, if you go away from the origin in either direction, you're going to keep getting better and better performance per watt. But you also have to write more and more parallel code and more restricted code. There's more burden on you, especially going upwards. You may have to program in a subset of the language. How are we going to handle that? That's one of the key challenges that I want to share some insights on how we might address. Now, where's hardware on this chart? Well, the Xbox 360 and most mainstream computers that your grandma has have GPUs, specialized vector cores, and complex, big, fat, out-of-order cores in the same box already. We've just been getting more and more anxious to make use of them because we're performance developers, okay? If you're in C++, you care about performance. You hate leaving performance on the table. And you look at this mainstream desktop, which now you can pretty much be guaranteed has a GPU attached, and you know it's 100 times faster to run your code there. You hate that. We hate doing that. It's like, give me that performance. I want it. My workload matches that. Now, if you go back to the 1980s, when the x86 and other mainstream processor families were getting started, they were simpler cores back then. There were fewer transistors. And gradually, over time, they got to the point where around 2005, where they got about as fat as you could go to make a single stream faster. And then you hit diminishing returns. And since then, we've got to more and more multiple cores. At the same time, GPUs have gone from the top left, where they've been disjoint memory, they've got their own memory and you have to copy, and they're specialized cores, and those from many vendors are moving to the left. They're moving toward more and more coherent, more and more shared memory, more and more the same address space toward the left. Now, the Fusion APU is doing something very similar to what we already have in mainstream desktops, but putting it on the same chip, and there are a lot of benefits to doing that. And we are going to see more, not less of that, including adding simple in-order cores to those same chips. It's pretty much inevitable, and the reason is because there are workloads that want all of these cores. Once you know that, the rest is a foregone conclusion. The chips will come, and the only thing in the way is our ability to program it, which is just a little problem. But from the hardware people's point of view, I mean, it's always the software people's fault. They should just work harder. That's the way it goes. Now, there's another trend, though, another facet of this trend we were talking about, which is cloud. If you look at where cloud is, it's talking about taking disjoint, loosely coupled cores that are big and out of order. That's the node-to-node distributed experience. Within each node, you have one or more, and hence those bottom two boxes are both part of this, inside the compute instance, one or more cores that are tightly coupled. So cloud goes across the bottom and takes some of each one of those buckets and puts them together, whether it's intra-node or inter-node. And cloud is now evolving. Just in the last 7 months or so, since last November, the industry is just beginning to say, well, you know what, if I've got these cloud instances, why don't I stick some GPU on there too? After all, I use it locally, why don't I just add it to the cloud? And now it multiplies. We'll come back to that near the end. But the main thing is once you start to look at this, you think, oh my goodness, what's going on? And if I had just showed you this slide with no build, you would have thought, what is this mess? And you might still be thinking, what is this mess? This is the jungle of heterogeneity. And the question is, how do we program it? Also, the question is, where is it going? And let me put forth a thesis. This is where we think hardware is going. We think hardware is going to be all over this map because every single one of these boxes has a workload that wants it. Some are going to be more popular than others, and what we're likely going to be seeing is scale in versus scale out. Scale in, where you have lots of varied local cores on die and in box, and they will tend to be more toward the more coherent memory, but notice they go up and down. They have all kinds of these processors. They just tend to be more of the coherent side. And then scale out, which is more the cloud and cluster, where we again have from top to bottom all these different kinds of cores, but more loosely coupled. And with everything in between. We'll see how loose and weak memory models go. It'll be interesting to see what happens to them. In all of this, the question is, how do we code for it? So where are today's programming models and languages? If you look at the attempts people have made and the products that are available to deal with multi-core, they mostly start near the bottom and then go a little bit up to simpler cores, and that's moving in the direction of being able to have weaker and weaker memory models, but it's mostly in strong shared memory models today, on chip and on board. GPU is going the other way. It's up at the vector cores, and it's going toward the stronger memory models from the more disjoint and the weaker ones, and it's moving to the left. But the entire bottom is for multi-core in the middle, and the entire top in the middle is for GPU and anything like it that we should choose to invent in the future that are specialized cores that do certain kinds of workloads really, really well. And cloud is starting in the bottom corner and moving up and a little bit to the left as people talk about private clouds. The most important thing to me is that when you're designing a programming model for any of these today, you should be designing for all of them because they're all on the same map. They're just different points on the same map. And we're excited about the ability to come up with something like that. Now the question is, where are standard languages today? ISO C++ today, if you looked at it in C++ 98, I should say, there was no such thing as threads in the standard. And people made jokes about that. The reality was we've been writing multi-threaded code in C++ for a long time, but not in standard portable code. And so now that C++ OX is here, it's in its final ballot as we speak, will be published this year, we expect, that now has a memory model, async, futures, threading, and it's now able more to take advantage of multiple cores. It still doesn't have some of the scalable parallelism and work-stealing runtime infrastructure and the surfaces on top of those, but it has more, and so it's moving in this direction. By the way, at this point, let me interrupt my prepared slides for a new slash you might have seen when you got up this morning. If you saw Slashdot posted around 2 a.m. this morning, this was for an article which, of course, was over a week old, but Slashdot found out about it today. C++, the clear winner in Google's language performance tests. As usual, it's true because Google said so. So now we know it's the truth. I don't know what Bing said, but Google said so. And from the article describing the paper, what they did is they took several languages, C++, Java, and other languages, and they did performance comparisons, measured, and discovered that C++ is the most powerful language that lets you get the most out of your hardware, highest performance language. In other news, grass is green and water is still wet. Now that we've had a bit of fun with that, different languages are good for different things. There's no one size fits all. And managed languages are great for productivity, for other things, but if you want power and performance, that's C++'s turf. It's also C's, but C++ gives you strong abstraction that you don't get, and it's the strongest abstracted language that lets you reason at a high level about your code without sacrificing performance and getting to the metal. And so when we go back to our picture, that will no longer be true if C++ cannot evolve. So we just had our little joke, and those of us who chuckled were C++ programmers and understand and love C++. Yes, people keep rediscovering every couple of years that C++ is fast and it's usable and it's modern. And we have our little joke. Our joke will stop if C++ doesn't get out of this box. Because by far the most of the power and the performance now is coming at the right end of the scale. If you look at those two, the scale in and scale out bubbles, we want to spread an entire one application across that entire thing in the future. In 5 years from now, that's where we want to be, where I can take one application and spread it across all those compute resources. Most of them are out of box. So we need to get out of this corner. And so we've had work like TBB and also the C++ PPL, which Microsoft did in our Visual Studio 2010 compiler, in order to be able to harness the power of C++ largely as a library, I'll talk about our design in a minute, to be able to use multi-core better. And we have direct compute, which is giving us access to GPUs in a really nice way, but it's in a different color because it's not C++, it's C. So we looked at this and said, okay, is there a way that we can bring C++ out to be able to deal today with GPUs? That's our focus in this first release, to deal with GPUs and to up-level DirectX and take advantage of C++ for all that it's good for. But have in mind this picture where in the future we can get you to write code today just for GPU that we can in future releases engineer underneath, so without changing your code or hardly changing your code, fewer no changes, you could recompile with a new compiler and we can spread your work even further. Can we get to a programming model that is future-proof, that solves GPU today, but has in mind that it's only one of the three facets of the larger trend of heterogeneous computing? Well, I'm pleased to announce today that what we have done is come up with C++ AMP. It stands for Accelerated Massive Parallelism, and I'll be pleased to tell you a little bit about it today. There'll be a session later on at 2 o'clock in room 406 where we're going to take more of a deeper dive. It's not in your programs, it was just added, so that's at 2 o'clock this afternoon. But let me give you a highlight of it. because you can see where it's intended for GPGPU today, where you can write C++ code and have it run at scale and much simpler because it's in a stronger language, run on any direct compute compatible device, and in the future, in future releases after that, to be able to extend that same programming model to multi-core in the cloud, to integrate that with PPL, and you'll notice it already looks a lot like PPL, and that's on purpose. Here's a quick example. Here's your serial code you might write, and the hello world of this stuff is matrix multiply, so let's do it. But on purpose, notice the parameters are different. One's a flat C array, because maybe you're giving the result as a flat C array to some code that wants it that way. But your inputs are standard vectors, they're C++ types. I can go through and write the code that does the serial loop nest, and on one core, we'll go and do the matrix multiply. It'll work, but it won't be fast. Here's what that code looks like in C++ AMP. I'll talk about what the array view is. It lets you view the array to deal with the bottom axis of data and abstract that away. You write a parallel for each, which if you have been using PPL already, this looks really familiar. You just use it with a different data type, notice c.grid, and you pass it a function to execute that has this restriction qualifier I'll talk about. That deals with the vertical axis of different cores. Now, the main thing I want you to take away from this first look is that there's very little change to your algorithm, to your actual program. The structure is still the same. It's a few lines difference. It is way simpler because we're in a higher level model. There's no dot copy or anything or dot sync in sight. I just wrote the code as a very STL-like algorithm with a couple of extra decorations. And the main difference is that the gold code on the right, compared to a typical CPU on typical mainstream GPUs, depending on what switch settings you use and how aggressive your compiler is, the gold code runs 10 to 100 times faster. That's what the difference is. Now, to illustrate what that's like, let me invite Daniel Moth, who's on our parallel computing platform team, and let's take a look at C++ AMP as it's running today. So, Daniel, I noticed that you have several pieces of hardware there. Can you tell us about the first one?
So first, let me log into this machine, which decided to sleep in the meantime. So thanks, Herb. So I have, as you can see here, various machines. And what I'd like to show you over the next few minutes is an application that relies on a compute-intensive algorithm, a data parallel algorithm specifically. So it's a prime candidate for taking that computation and offloading it to an accelerator, such as the various AMD hardware that I have over here. So I'm going to show you the same application running on various hardware, and I'll be tweaking things in the user interface and showing the various speedups that we get under different configurations. Now, of course, not all compute-intensive applications have to be visual, but in a demo, it helps if they are, so you can actually observe those performance benefits. So let's go and do that. So I'm going to execute this application that we call an N-body simulation because it simulates bodies. So each dot that you see here on the screen is what we call a body, and the algorithm is basically calculating the velocity and position of each body in relation to every other body before each frame.
So I'm seeing this running, Daniel. What kind of hardware are we running on? My understanding, if I remember right, this is the chip that was just announced yesterday, the quad-core fusion chip.
Correct. So what you're seeing here, for those of you that can see the stage, is the lower tower. So this is the APU, is the Llano that was announced yesterday. But what we're running on at this point is on the CPU, on a single core. Mm-hmm. And the number of bodies on the screen, you can count them, or you can just look up here in the left corner. It tells you we've got about 4,000 bodies. And it tells you below that we're getting about 9 frames per second, and we're getting just over 3 gigaflops. The other thing I can do here, of course, I can rotate. So there's some gratuitous features in here that I don't really need to show you, but I will anyway because they're fun. So you can zoom in, zoom out, rotate, and do all kind of stuff like that, or just reset so you start from the picture in the beginning. So if I just go now and throw more bodies at this, what do you think is going to happen? So the more bodies we put, the more computation has to take place. So we can see if the CPU can handle that. So I've got a slide that I can just go up a couple of notches. So now I've thrown another 1,000 bodies on it. And as you can see now, over here, the gigaflops stay the same, which means we're maxing out the power we can get out of this CPU. And the frames per second have dropped, so we cannot do more computation. So at this point, you want to actually use something else so you can get the benefits of the full benefits of the hardware that is in that machine. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch to actually use the APU, the GPU bit that's on next to the CPU. So we'll do that. And what do you think is going to happen? Picture that in your head.
So
and now you
running,
see it on the screen.
So that's running on the onboard vector unit built on the APU chip.
Exactly. Obviously, I heard the wow from this side of the room. I hope I'll hear another one from that side in a minute. But what you're seeing is we're getting now 116 frames per second, and we're getting close to, we're getting 60 gigaflops, basically. However, this is just using the load I had previously on the CPU. What we can do with data parallel algorithms is throw more data, and that's how we fully harness the hardware. So I can go here, and let's get, say we go up to, let's just throw more and more. Let's go to 16,000 bodies. And you can see that we're still getting a nice visual over here. The frames per second have dropped, but now you can see we're going up to 100, over 100 gigaflops that we're getting just out of this APU that is in this box. However, when I got this box, I noticed that it had inside a discrete GPU card, one that's been around from AMD for over a year now. So what would happen if I just wanted to use that using the same C++ ARM technology that we use to build this application? So again, picture that in your head. So we can reset here and then go and use the other GPU, and now it's basically screaming fast. Still no wow from that side. That's okay. I won't hold that against you.
So we've used just the single CPU, then we used the APU that was on board on the die, then we used the discrete GPU card.
You've got it. So now on the discrete GPU card, we're seeing 370 gigaflops, and we've got 70 frames per second. And of course, what I can do is I can just throw more bodies because I've got powerful hardware here. So we just throw more bodies, and you can see that the gigaflops just keep going up. And what I could even do is use both the APU and the GPU together, so in a multi-device scenario, and throw there 40,000 bodies, you know, something the CPU couldn't imagine. Thank you very much for playing, sir.
Wow.
And now we're going over to 630 gigaflops.
Thank you very much. So now, Daniel, so now we're harnessing the APU and the GPU, because we can spread the workload across whatever parallelism there is.
Exactly.
Now, you've got that application. One of the key things I want us to be able to accomplish is to be able to take a single executable and ship it shrink-wrapped and have it run on any hardware that DirectX supports from any vendor in any combination with a single executable. Can you take that executable onto some other hardware, please?
Exactly. That's what our friend from AMD, Robin, asked. He came one day into my office and said, because that's all I was planning to show you, and said, can you do that same thing on this little ultra-thin laptop from HP? And first I laughed, I thought it was a joke. But then he said, no, this actually has an APU in it that's been in the market for a few months, in fact.
An E-series, I think.
So let's go and just reset this again. So here you can see I'm running 2,000 bodies on the CPU, and we're getting 11 frames per second, as you'd expect from this laptop, and just under one gigaflop. So let's see if we can get a bit more performance out of the APU on this tiny little machine. So we can go and just switch to this. And again, you're seeing that we are getting visually a better experience, and we're getting 60 frames per second, 5 gigaflops. And you know the trick by now. When you have such powerful data parallel hardware, what do? You throw more data at it. You can do more. So we can go now and put the bodies up, let's say, to another almost 8,000, and now we're getting 12 frames per second, and we're getting 15 gigaflops out of this, which is not bad, I think, from a tiny little machine like that.
Not bad for a netbook.
Not bad for a notebook. So if we just go and I can make it crawl visually.
Bring it to its knees.
Exactly, and that's what I've just done. So we're getting 2 frames per second only, but 18 gigaflops. You just do more. That's the nature of data parallelism. So I know what you're going to ask me, Herb, now, is can I run this on yet another machine?
Well, I noticed you had another big box there.
Exactly, and it's not just for show. So again, for those of you that can see the stage, the big tower over there doesn't have an APU in it. It's just one of the a machine without one. We'd managed to get one of those. So what we'll do is we'll... So what we'll do is unlock the workstation. Remember I mentioned my friend from AMD, Robin? This is Robin.
Hey, Robin.
Thanks, Robin. So what do we have on this machine?
See, Windows is secure. Sorry. Keep going.
Tell me when you're done. So what we have here is the same application, like Herb said. So we take the same binary, run it over here. CPU story, you know the story by now. So we're running on the CPU. We're getting this kind of performance. And what shall we do? Well, let's just first switch to the discrete GPU here. So this is what you see. You're now used to this, right? So no applause. That's fine. You can see 300-something frames per second on 112 gigaflops. Let's throw more bodies. How many bodies shall I throw at this? Let's go up to 12,000, and it's all looking very good, very interactive. We can do all that kind of stuff. Let's go to 15,000, and you can see almost 100 frames per second, 470 gigaflops. But you know what? On this machine, I have two discrete GPUs that have been around for over a year. So do you want to see what happens when we use both of them?
Yes. Woo.
All right, let's go and do that. So I'm just going to go and switch to the multi-GPU. Of course, the color becomes blue just for fun, and now we're getting 560 gigaflops, 100-something frames per second. I can go all the way, 32,000 in this example. We're getting 800-something gigaflops with 37 frames per second. I could get more, but my slider doesn't go any further, so we'll have to update our user interface to really take advantage of such hardware. And I think that's all I have time for to show you over here. If you're interested to see the code that you have to write, it's the kind of code, the kind of API you have to use to write this kind of application, please come to my talk. It's not in your printed booklets. It was a late-minute edition. 2 p.m. in room 406. I'd love to show you more. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daniel. One executable that you can shrink wrap and will just use any heterogeneous hardware that's there. We're pretty excited about that. And yesterday, you saw Phil Rogers use this slide. And when you look at the left, the right-hand side of the architected era, where we have full C++, where we can deliver this to mainstream programmers, we think C++ AMP is the kind of thing that is an example of this. And we agree that's what you need. Now, why C++ AMP? Because there are already ways to program GPUs. But let me give you five reasons. Microsoft didn't just decide to do another one because they're Microsoft, although there's a history of that, but not this time. First of all, a lot of those existing APIs were about C, and we feel C++ is important to use the strong typing, to use the strong, powerful abstractions while still being close to the metal, overloading, templates, exceptions. We think it's important for it to be mainstream, that you don't have to write hello world in a page and a half like you did with Windows 1.0, that you do with parallel processing 1.0 today, that programmable by millions of developers. We also think that it's important not to mess with the language more than you have to. And if you can do it without changing the language at all, so much the better. Minimal language extension, not just prying stuff in the language because it seems like a good idea. Portable, like I showed, mix and match hardware from any vendor and run one executable that you can spread across all of that hardware, one program. And finally, general and future-proof, because we're dealing with GPU today, but to make sure that we can give you this programming model where you write a parallel for each and it just will be GPU in the first release, but that we can give you new releases where with little or no code change, we can spread it across multi-core and the cloud as well. That's where we would like to be. So if you step back to what we did in Visual Studio 2010 and the Visual C++ team, when we wanted to do our part in taking our customers from single core to multi-core, well, ISO C++ OX didn't have support for multi-core parallel runtime, so we need to add it. Could it be done as a library? What is the right way to do that? Well, you'll find a lot of people who tried approaches like saying, well, let's see, we have to use more cores. Loops are a fundamental construct. We must need some sort of parallel loop in the language. That must be the way to do it. And sometimes you end up with several weird kinds of parallel loops because it turns out there's different kinds of parallel loops you need. Sometimes you need to do one thing, sometimes another. Some loops only worked with some data, and other loops did only certain kinds of traversals. We don't think the right answer is to litter the language with one-off features that don't integrate with each other. So we looked back at this and said, you know what, we don't need parallel loops. We already can write loops in STL, they work just fine. What we do need is one horizontal language feature, which was not in C++ at the time, but is now in C++ OX, and that is lambda functions. And it turns out that when you have this horizontal feature of being able to take a piece of code and pass it around like an object, you get two important things. First, we could write all the rest of the parallel patterns library, PPL, as just a library. As just a library. If you look at multicore, it is not obvious when you first start looking at the problem that the holy grail language feature you want that solves all your problems plus lots of single core usage cases is lambda functions, because what in the description of lambda functions screams parallel? But that's the feature you need to enable you to write the rest of it as a library. And so we learned from that, and we also contributed our experience back to the standards body that we're actively participating in, that I'm glad to be a participant, long-time participant of. And the syntax now for C++OX lambda functions, which, as I said, are now in their final ballot, and now available in more and more compilers, the syntax you were using is the syntax that we discovered worked best for PPL and contributed back to the standards body and was adopted as that syntax. And so we're very glad to have been able to play a small part, and many others did, in bringing lambda functions. But that made everything better for everybody. One language feature in our last release of Visual Studio for multicore, and it did all sorts of other things for STL and functors and callbacks and events as well. So now we're on parallelism phase two. How do we get from ISO C++OX to enable this demo that you just saw and more to the cloud? We believe you need exactly one language feature, and it is all about being able to talk about that vertical axis. You need the ability to be able to say, I want to express a subset of the language. For this function, I want to write in a subset of the language. And if you can express the ability to talk about a language subset in the language itself and overload on it and dispatch on it, it turns that out that is a hugely powerful feature. Now you can write a parallel for each algorithm that looks very much like what you wrote in PPL, but you write items.grid. It is, in fact, an overload in the same namespace. And you still pass it a lambda function, but now you just say it's restricted to run so that the code inside is that which can run not just on the CPU, but on any DirectX 11 compute device. So you don't get go-to, sorry. You don't get exceptions today. And we can relax those in the future. You don't get function pointers or pointers to pointers. Most of the rest of the language is right there. We believe with one language feature, we can enable that whole landscape because we can deal with the second dimension through a library type. So let me talk about that. Here's C++ AMP as a glance. We believe any successful model for dealing with not just GPU, but also with cloud and multicore as a single cohesive problem, any solution is going to have these two facets in some form. You're going to have something that deals with the cores are different, and you're going to have something that deals with memory is different. To deal with cores are different, that you may have only a subset of the language available way up there, the ability to restrict the language that you're using. By the way, restrict is conveniently a C99 keyword. We are not colliding with that. This is a new meaning of restrict, but it was a very nice word and already reserved in C99, so that seemed like the natural way to continue following the path that the standards bodies had already been paving. Now, to deal with memory, how often, if we've used iterators in STL, have we wished for ranges? Well, array views are n-dimensional ranges that give you a view of any array, any vector, but dimensionally safe. Let me talk about those two. So restrict, some cores don't support the entire C++ language, that's the problem. The solution, general restriction qualifiers to express language subsets. So for example, if you're shipping a library that where you might have the same implementation, the same code that can run on the CPU or on the GPU, then you do what line 2 says. You just do double cos and you say restrict direct3D. You provide a single function, a single implementation that the compiler and language enforces. You use only the subset of the language that will work across all those devices, CPU and GPU. But now let's say that same library writer for another function like sine, you actually have a different implementation, either because you have only a subset of the language, your main implementation of sine uses features that aren't available on the GPU, or perhaps you have a more optimal implementation for the GPU. In either case, just overload, and it just works. So you write your parallel for each, and if you're in that restrict direct3D context, we will simply call the write function. The dispatch is done at compile time, but it is as if dynamic. So just think of it as dynamic, but like many things in C++, it is done at compile time very, very efficiently. The initially supported restriction qualifiers are CPU, which is the implicit default, so you'll never see me write it on these slides because it's just there. That's what all existing functions are restricted CPU. You can write it, but it's redundant. And restrict Direct3D can execute on any DX11 device through direct compute. Now, that's all for our first release. We're targeting GPU. But just to show you, this general language subsetting is not just about GPU. It's not just even about computation. Imagine other things you might want to subset in the language. For instance, pure functions. The ability to say a function has no side effects. That's a subset of the language. I'm not allowed to do anything but mess with local variables. I can't write outside memory. That's a subset. Now imagine if in some future release you had restrict pure and you pass that kind of function to a plain Jane STL sequential for each, which now we knew was safe to automatically parallelize without you doing anything. That's the kind of thing that this very powerful, one feature, but very broad and powerful, the kind of path that opens up and enables. Now we deal with the other axis through an array view. The idea is that I have parameters here in the matrix multiply example that may be a C array or maybe a standard vector. And either one of those, we prefer vectors, but we deal with C arrays too, we can simply wrap and have a view of, an n-dimensional view of, and then when we construct the view, we tell it the dimensions because vectors don't know their dimensions. The programmer knows, but now we can express it in a type-safe way. And we simply access those views inside the parallel for each. That's all. Now, if you've done GPGPU programming, you're going to say, well, where's the copy? It's implicit. I have a view of data. It's agile. If I use it over on a direct compute device, over on the GPU, I copy. That's what I do today. And in the future, we can elide those copies. If you have a single address space, but it's not synchronized, we can simply sync it for you. And you get a lot of the performance right out of the box without ever saying copy or sync, and that insulates you from the memory architecture. Now, this is C++, so there's always a way to open the hood and take care of it yourself if you want to have direct control over it. If you know you're on particular hardware or you want to really get down to the metal, we will let you do that. But the default is you just say a view of an array, and it's agile. And wherever it needs to go, that's where it will be implicitly taken and then copied back. And it's not stupid. It's done smartly, because if you notice, the input vectors of the matrix multiplication, did you notice we wrap them in an array view of const float? We're not going to modify them. So we need to ship them to the GPU. We don't care about copying them back. There's no copy back. That's optimized automatically. And all you had to do to make that happen was to say const, which has been in the language for over 20 years. Now, there is no anti-const. It would be nice if there was a CV qualifier in the language that was write-only. And we were tempted to add one, because then it'd be like 1.5 language features. But for this release, it's fine to have write-only of T as a template. It works just as well. So no gratuitous language extension. We could do it as a template. So in the future, it could be useful. I can imagine many uses for a write-only CV qualifier. But for now, it means output-only, which means that when I ship the work over to the GPU, I don't bother copying over the original values that are random in that array. I only copy back the result one way. And all I had to say was write only. Now, this wouldn't be for the mainstream if it weren't for tools. And we know that many, many developers use Visual Studio and especially have enjoyed the parallel debugging and profiling that have been in the product since our last release. We know that a lot of people actually keep hearing about people who use Visual Studio even though they're not targeting Windows platforms at all. And, well, that's not really what we had in mind, but that's just fine. And if people love the tool, that's a lot of love. And so we want to make sure we bring that also to GPUs. And so here are some mock-ups of what that might look like, just looking at what Visual Studio 2010 already has. And being able to say all the things on that you want to say about debugging CPU also to the GPU, to be able to have your IntelliSense, to be able to have your parallel stacks where you can drill into hundreds of threads and see what they're doing, to be able to look at GPU threads and see which ones have diverged, because on hardware where warps are important, if you're familiar with that detail, you want to make sure that they're all executing the same branches of the same code, and we can be able to tell you things like whether those threads are diverged, and so you can further improve performance. Profiling. Being able to see where your hotspots are and show your CPUs and GPUs at the same time. That's just a taste of what we think it means to bring it to the mainstream That includes not just having fun writing code, it also means tools in Visual Studio. Let me just finish with a word about scale, because if you look at from, about the last ice age until now, we've been making a single thread of execution get faster and faster till about 2005 when the free lunch was over, and we made this turn to more and more out-of-order CPUs. And during that time period, more trends have emerged. More recently, vendors have announced going to lots of in-order CPUs, taking us part of the way back, but still general purpose, to have more GPUs. And those today already have been in the market for general purpose computation for a couple of years. And we're talking easily thousands of cores. I could, without lying, make that number higher. But in the mainstream, the bulk of the market, we're already in that range. But cloud also matters. And it's hard to get numbers on exactly how big the biggest cloud applications are, but it's fair to say they are already at least approaching 100,000 cores. At least approaching 100,000 cores. And now what happens to this graph in the amount of parallelism available to your application, to one application, if you have cloud plus GPU? Well, this is a logarithmic scale, so you just add those two lines, and you go up, and you go up, and you go up, and you scale to roughly 10 to 100 million today. You can write this code today. It's not easy, it's not for the mainstream, but you can write a single application today, and if you don't think that's game-changing, how long is your password? And how long will it take 100 million GPU cores running at, what, a million attempts per second to crack your password just by brute force, that we're almost to where a kid could write that. And that is just the tiniest example of how game-changing this is. So the free lunch is so over. We are now well into the parallel revolution, but now the question is heterogeneity, enabling heterogeneous computing and bringing it to the mainstream. So C++ AMP, that's what we have. It is C++, not C. It is in our next version of Visual Studio. We believe it's mainstream. We think it's great that people who will be able to use STL, if you can use STL, you can use the C++ AMP as well. It's minimal. We take you to heterogeneous computing with a single language extension, bringing C++ to the GPU and the GPU to C++. It's portable. You can already, as we've already shown, mix and match hardware, multiple pieces of hardware from any vendor that's available through, accessible through direct compute. And we believe it's about more than just GPU. Our eye is on the longer ball. We're doing this today because this has great value, just doing the GPU. But that's only one facet of the trend to heterogeneous parallel computing, that it also includes multi-core and cloud, and compute devices at all scales. So that's C++ AMP. Now, there's one more thing. Not all of you are using Microsoft platforms. Many of you looked at the screenshots of Visual Studio. Maybe it's the first time you saw them. And we know that people develop software on all sorts of systems. We also think that open specifications and open standards are important. For the last 15 years, I personally have been spending time in the C++ and SQL standards committees, doing a lot of work, spending a lot of trip time and midnight time working on standards, and I've had the privilege of even running the standards committee for the last number of years for C++. We really believe that C++ AMP brings C++ to GPU and heterogeneous computing in general, and brings heterogeneous computing to C++. And we don't want to keep that just for ourselves. We've learned a lot from doing this. We think it's the cleanest design we've been able to come up with after scrapping many that weren't. And we want to make that available. So I'm very pleased to announce that Microsoft intends to make C++ AMP an open specification that any compiler can implement. And we are working with our hardware partners to help them to build C++ AMP into C++ compilers for any hardware target, for any operating system target they want. We're helping them. And we're also pleased to announce that one of those is AMD, that AMD will be implementing C++ AMP in their FSA reference compiler for Windows and non-Windows platforms. Yeah, we're very glad about that. So that's C++ AMP. If you want to find more about what we're doing for multi-core with PPL, we're also doing more work there to bring that forward, and we'll merge those technologies together. There's a session immediately following this one. And the C++ AMP, more of what you've just seen, 2 o'clock at room 406. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.